This week on Writers, Inc.
The first thing you have to do is be able to tell the truth, and you have to be able to be fearless. And then once you have that, then only then can you truly start building your brand.
J.K. Rowling was nearly homeless when she wrote the first Harry Potter book. Stephen King penned Carrie in a small desk wedged between a washer and dryer. James Patterson worked in advertising and famously crafted the Toys R Us theme song long before becoming an author. Join New York Times bestseller J.D. Barker and a panel of industry powerhouses as they pull back the curtain on some of the world's most prolific authors. Where did they start? What is their process? The biggest names in publishing all have origin stories, all have tips and secrets. What does it take to consistently top the bestseller lists and become a household name? Get your notepad out, school's in session. This is Writers, Inc.
Hi, it's Christine Daigle.
I'm Jenna Brown.
I'm Kevin Tomlinson.
And I'm J.D. Barker. Welcome to Writers, Inc. So I sent this to you guys right before we started recording, so we didn't really get a chance to talk about it. But David Morrell put something up on Twitter, or I'm sorry, X. I need to change that in my head.
About a
fake publishing company overseas that's basically mimicking a real publishing company, like well enough to basically pull off that they, you know, people can't tell the difference. Everything about the site is fake. Like the employees are all AI generated, the bios, all the information. And it's pretty frightening because they're getting some big dollar amounts out of people. I wanted to research it before we got on the air, but I didn't get a chance.
Yeah. This stuff is so rampant. It's like, it reminds me of the Ingram Spark, fake that we were talking about on another episode, just to a more elevated level, I suppose, of sophistication. Yeah. Check your websites. Double check.
Well, I guess just the thing is like you just know publishing won't make you pay. Like if someone's asking you for an upfront cost, agent, publisher, like no one should be asking you to pay.
No.
Except me. If you pay me, I will publish you.
Wow.
I will. I promise you.
That is true with what I consider to be legitimate publication, but vanity presses are still alive and well, and there are many people out there that will gladly pay a vanity press to put their book out. These guys fall right into that. I guess the real distinguishing factor with this one, and I should have this information in front of me. I am a horrible host. but the company name that the fake company is using is the same as a real publisher that is out there, or at least close enough where people can't tell the difference. Right. And that's what's creating the confusion. Cause if they Google them, they've got legitimate stuff that they're seeing. You have to really dig down into the weeds to realize that, the domain was actually only purchased 2 months ago instead of 10 years ago.
Yeah, it was somewhere in Australia, and I forget what it was. One of them was something books, and the fake is something books publishing. So they just took their name and put publishing on the end. So
that's devious.
It is
that's
devious. Yeah.
I've been seeing other stuff lately too, AI related. Like you can do a Zoom call and you can basically be somebody else in that Zoom call. It can completely filter you out and replace you with another persona. So a man can be a woman can be a man. Like you can completely change everything down to your voice, which means they can now fake that. Even the communication itself, like that could be AI. You could be having a full-on email chain conversation going on with an AI.
Or a video conversation with an AI.
Yeah, it's probably some kid in the Philippines writing all this stuff. He's hanging out on the beach watching his bank account, while these bots basically do the nasty work for him.
Yeah. Say potato.
Say potato, Elizabeth. Say potato.
For anyone listening, I know we get kind of a mixed crowd of authors listening to the show, but if you're new to this and you're coming in and you're thinking about a vanity press, there's really no reason to do a vanity press. There's no reason to pay anybody to publish your work. There's a million companies out there. Well, okay, that's an exaggeration. There's like five companies out there that will do it for free. There's a little bit of work on your part, but a lot less than you might think. Don't pay anyone to publish your books.
Did you just say five? There's five companies.
There's like five companies.
Six now.
The only one I use is Draft2Digital. I like Draft2Digital best because it just takes like a 10% cut of royalties instead of me having to pay them anything. Because the others actually do have fees, I think, or can have fees depending on how you use them. But yeah. No need to pay anybody for this stuff, really. Yeah. Honestly.
Because I am a lousy host, we actually got a listener question or a comment from last week, and I didn't get a chance to forward it to you guys. But It is from Brian C. He said, love the show with regard to Kindle translation. So it was our, you know, us discussing the new Amazon translated versions of your books. I'm traditionally published and I'm in a few different countries. Foreign publishers provide more value than just the translation. They know their local market and it can be very different from the States. Right. That is a very, very good point that I didn't even think about. So like I'm in 150 different countries. My book pretty much has a different cover in every one of those countries. Right. And a lot of those covers make zero sense to me. It's not something I would put on a book here in the States, but that is, you know, what is it, you know, what is trending in that particular part of the world. You know, right down to the fonts that they use, the colors that they use, you know, where they market your book locally, the press, the bloggers, the influencers, the people they talk to. Like they're bringing a lot more to the table than just the translation. Like that's just a starting point.
Yeah, we were talking about that this week with you know, because I had asked how your whole thing in Belgium and Amsterdam happened, and you have another one coming up that I won't talk about. But I think it's also the support that they're giving you to fly you over there, do these events, meet your readers. Like you don't get that from a translation bot.
When it comes to the actual language, there, you know, there's regional dialects and things like that to consider. So, you know, if you were going to get your book translated into Chinese, well, there's multiple versions of Chinese. There's multiple versions of Spanish. And getting it sort of localized and regionalized is kind of a big part of these foreign rights.
Yeah, that's actually another very good point. So my Spanish publisher is located in Spain, but they cover Spanish on a worldwide basis. And like you just said, like there are different translations for Colombia and Venezuela and Honduras and Mexico than Spain and like that part of the world. Like they've got different translations happening everywhere. So just because we call it one language, there's really there's a lot of different variants going on out there.
Yeah.
And I don't know how Amazon's going to handle that either. I mean, at some point they'll probably work that in, but I doubt that they're doing that out of the gate.
Yeah.
So anyway, all right, what is in the news?
Well, first up, Shein expands into bookselling with Alibri partnership. Shein took over the world of fast fashion and now is entering book selling via partnership with Alibri, adding over 100,000 used titles plus affordable textbooks to Shein's U.S. marketplace in time for the holidays. The move targets Gen Z's renewed interest in print. In Shein's survey, a third of respondents read daily or weekly, with romance, fantasy, and mystery leading. Shein says it will expand the Alibri selection over the coming months to meet growing demand from its community.
This is interesting to me.
My biggest takeaway out of this was Gen Z's renewed interest in print.
This is the first time I've heard
I like
that.
But yeah, I don't. I know that this company, this fashion company, they do these like TikTok hauls for like fashion and stuff like that. So I'm wondering if now we're going to start seeing books in their TikTok hauls.
What's a TikTok haul?
Like you can get all this stuff bundled together. It's like,
I've been saying about this renewed interest in print for quite some time. Like they keep saying like millennials, you know, like with Bookstagram and now it's Gen Z and TikTok. But I kind of feel like, I don't know, like social media sort of makes it very tangible where people do like to have books and, you know, physical things. And book hauls have always been a thing on Bookstagram, but I don't know if they're as popular on TikTok. So it is kind of an interesting thing to now see the influencer trends sort of reemerge. But TikTok, I don't know, seems maybe to have gained more ground than Bookstagram, but Bookstagram put a pretty big, it did a lot for publishing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, do you remember this trend when people were wearing outfits to match their books? Maybe they can do that all.
Yeah.
Just like, here's an outfit that matches this book and put it all together. That'd be kind
of fun. There's been a lot. Yeah. So it'll be kind of interesting to see what they do, you know, because Bookstagram at its height was just photos. And so it was, you know, very just that. So with Reels now, and I guess with TikTok, just TikTok is TikTok. It'll be fun. Good. I'm glad. More books for everyone.
Yeah, I kind of think there's definitely a trend back towards a more analog approach to everything. And it may be part of that whole slow living movement. So I am kind of glad to see this happening because it almost seems like, doesn't it seem sort of like Gen Z is just, this is their way of being rebellious is by like shifting back to, well, I'm going to use a rotary phone or,
I don't know if it's rebellious as much as like AI. You know, like you can't, I don't know most of what I watch anymore. Like, sort of the joy of like watching animal videos has been destroyed with AI because most of it is all AI now. And
That's right.
so you kind of like, I don't know, like there's something about like social media that sort of God, I don't like it's I'm just not inclined to do it anymore because I'm like, well, that's AI.
Yeah.
I wonder if it's because a lot of the Gen Zers, like their jobs revolve around technology. You know, they're working with their phones, their iPads,
Oh,
their
that's a good
computers. They're on
point
that
too.
stuff all the time. So who wants to come home and then stare at that same screen to relax? You look for something different.
That's a very good point. That's kind of like I had a call with the guy, the new marketing guy at Scrivener a couple of days ago, and we were talking about how like I told him that, you know, I've been writing all my life, and then I was a copywriter for decades in the marketing world. And it wasn't until I switched to Scrivener that I was able to really, I was writing books in like Microsoft Word, but it felt tedious and heavy all the time. But just switching environments made it like open up for me. And I think it's kind of something similar. Like, you know, yeah, you could, they're probably, you know, you could play an infinite playlist of music from Spotify, but it's kind of more interesting to have that record player and some vinyl, you know. I think that's what's happening. It's like they just it's sort of the same but different. It's like a novelty, but it's also just an embracing of you know, like a more analog lifestyle, I think. Whatever. I talk a little bit about this on my YouTube channel, by the way. Go subscribe. Second up, quick plug right there. So, Sourcebooks cracks the big five. Sourcebooks is now number five in U.S. print sales, edging past Macmillan per internal analysis of Circana Book Scan. Macmillan counters it's still number five when all formats and dollars are included. Though 75% owned by Penguin Random House, Sourcebooks operates independently and also manages Callisto. Heavy focus on print has driven explosive growth. The house is scaling fast, staff up 55%, new teams for international, bespoke publishing and fandom marketing, plus integrated publicity and marketing for each imprint.
I'd love to get somebody from Sourcebooks on the podcast just to talk about all this because they've honestly come kind of from nowhere. They, you know, the company's not that old, right? Maybe 10 years, 15 years at the most. But they've cultivated some very, very big names. You know, like Freedom McFadden is on there, you know, a bunch of other ones. And they built those. I think it's kind of funny that Macmillan's, you know, kind of pointing out, well, if you include ebooks and you include this and that, we're still ahead. But I think the hardest mountain to climb is to actually, you know, hit number five because of print. You know, like print seems to be the hardest way to get it done, and they're beating them, you know, based on that. But that's really cool. I'd love to hear that from the people behind it.
So is it the big six now? Is that where
On
we're
it.
at? The big six instead
Let's
of the
call
big
it
five?
that.
The
Maybe. That's how
It's the big
Macmillan stays in the game.
4.5.
big four and a half.
I'm glad to see it. I want to see more of this. I want to see, you know, I kind of want to see the whole marketplace get this inevitable shakeup that it's getting, but also like I want to see new powerhouses emerge. I you know, there's something of a monopoly on the industry, and I think it's hurt the business. I think that's part of the reason why there's been a decline in reading and book sales is because, you know, look at what they tend to do. They tend to, it's just like the Hollywood system. Like they tend to only gravitate towards the, you know, what they think is a sure hit. And so that they take fewer risks. And so you get less breakout, less new discovery. And so people aren't as excited about it anymore. If I just want to read the same old stuff all the time, I got plenty of books to choose from, but getting something new and innovative and exciting, that's, you know, the indie world is kind of doing a lot of that, but it, you know, they have a discoverability problem because they don't have shelf space and stuff like that. So, yeah, I kind of want to see growth in this area. All right, last story: predatory opt-outs. The speculators come for the Anthropic copyright settlement. An Arizona law firm called Claims Hero is aggressively urging authors to opt out of the Anthropic copyright settlement, promising the possibility of much bigger payouts. Even though they have no connection to the case and are pushing authors toward a speculative lawsuit that may never happen. Plaintiff's counsel and Judge Alsup have accused Claims Hero of using misleading and deceptive tactics, including ads that exaggerate potential damages. The judge called the effort, quote, a fraud of immense proportions, ordered Claims Hero to take down or correct its materials, and demanded the names of any authors who signed up. Authors who opt out lose their guaranteed settlement payment, potentially remove co-rights holders without warning, and gamble on a future lawsuit that may fail or never be filed. Writers should make this decision carefully and not be swayed by promises of, quote, huge payouts. More money, more problems.
This one bothers me for a couple different reasons. Like, any class action suit that I've ever seen or been part of or read about, like, the piece that you get is nowhere near the piece that you actually deserve or should have gotten based on whatever, you know, crime was committed. And that's kind of where we're at with Anthropic. You know, like, they've got a settlement out there. The judge is obviously going to push for it because this makes everything go away without the company having to fold. But the authors, you know, the bottom line is they're not getting compensated what they should be based on this. You know, but, you know, when you look at this, though, like, this is not the way to do it either. There's not another class action suit that you can jump onto. You're basically giving up a little bit, you know, that you would have gotten for zero. So that's not a win either. Yeah. And there really is no right answer. I mean, the only right answer would be for every author to sue Anthropic individually and take that company down for doing it, and then go after ChatGPT and go after every single one of them to, you know, take them all down. And then the next guy who comes up to the plate's not going to do that. They're going to find some other way to create AI without it. In my mind, that's the right way to do it. That is never going to happen. I think at this point, if you're an author, if you're getting part of that settlement, I think you just need to take the little bit that they're willing to give you, because it's probably all you're ever going to see.
Yeah. You know, if I were Anthropic, I might have actually created a company like Claims Hero, got a law firm on board to do this, just to get people to pull out of the class action. Not to be devious. All conspiracy theorists about it, but I'm just saying, if I were a multi-billion dollar company trying to save my bottom line.
I'm a bigger conspiracy theorist than you. It's fine. It's fine, Kevin.
Yeah. Yeah, the problem is it's expensive to file lawsuits individually. So most people don't have the means to do that. So, yeah.
Well, anyway. And I guess, like, the too good to be true, right? Like, when something's too good to be true, like, even if, like JD said, it's deserved or just, right? Like, you know, sometimes getting something definite is better than a potential maybe. And especially the more questionable that maybe becomes, right? Because, like you said, it's expensive. And there are legal things that companies do all the time to avoid lawsuits, you know, bankruptcy, or they sell to someone else. And now, like, you know, I don't know the ins and outs particularly of that law, but I know that they are very clever when it comes to their legal loopholes. So, I would just say be careful.
Yeah.
I kind of doubt anybody is ever going to see, anybody but the lawyers will ever see anything more than maybe a Starbucks gift card out of this whole scenario. Like, I've never, any of these things I've ever been involved in, you know, the class action is spread out so much that even if they got a verdict for, like, billions of dollars, thing that hits your $10. Pocket is like a, you know, at most. I mean, I got to be thrilled by $10. Yeah. I had a check one time from an Apple class action for $1.35, you know, and it was for my keyboard that I actually had to pay $300 out of pocket to have them fix.
Yeah.
So I recouped an entire $1.35 for my trouble. So, I don't have much faith in anything.
Yeah.
You have a story. Share it with the world. Ingram Spark offers everything you need to publish, promote, sell, and print your book. Reach millions of readers worldwide with powerful tools created for independent authors. Get started for free at ingramspark.com/learn more.
All right, JD, who's up this week?
This week, we've got Richard Kirschenbaum on. Richard's the CEO and founder of SWG SWAT, a high-profile boutique branding agency he launched in 2011. His latest novel is called The Hollywood Fix, and it centers around the real-life star makers in Tinseltown, the Fixers. I really like this one. Here he is, Richard Kirschenbaum.
All right, Richard, welcome to the show.
Oh, I'm so happy and excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we're excited to have you. So you come from the world of advertising and branding. What made you want to write fiction?
Well, I think I've always been in a field that's been about storytelling. And I started out also as a comedy writer, wrote for Joan Rivers, among other people. And I had, you know, a journey in my career as a copywriter. So it's been, you know, the written word has always been my, you know, avocation and something I love. And so it was natural that I've evolved into a novelist.
Yeah. And so was Rouge your debut that you did with St. Martin's, or had you written books before?
I've done a few couple of business books, and I did, you know, a relationship book. Yeah. But Rouge was my first novel. And it was well received. And then it was optioned by the famous, wonderful, and fabulous Wendy Finerman, who is currently doing the new Devil Wears Prada movie, which I had a cameo in.
Oh, nice.
And she sold that to Sony. So there's always been a lot of interest in my work as well in Hollywood.
Yeah, that's great. So how did you go about getting into the publishing industry, finding an agent, getting published? What did that journey look like for you?
Yeah, I mean, it's always very difficult to find the right people. And I think over time, one must look at it as a journey of bringing the right people on, making sure if they're a great fit, great. And if not, then continuing to add to your team. You know, so it's finding a great entertainment lawyer. Then it's finding, you know, it's someone who to work with in, you know, Hollywood, if you're interested in, you know, doing that in terms of selling your IP. I think it was through a great deal of word of mouth, and I met the wonderful and talented Laura York, who has been in the publishing field for many years. And Laura has really guided me through my career and through helping me evolve as a writer, and has introduced me to, you know, all the wonderful people that I know.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So let's talk a little bit about your current book, The Hollywood Fix. What interested you in exploring covering up the activities of actors in the golden age of Hollywood?
Yeah, well, I've always been interested in that subject matter. My wife, interestingly enough, was a very well-known celebrity publicist for many years, handling some of the major, major movie stars. I mean, she was the publicist for Julia Roberts, among others, and people like that. So I've had a firsthand look at PR. I've owned PR companies myself. And I thought that it was, you know, a really interesting topic. I kept reading amazing biographies about the golden age of Hollywood. And I said, you know, there hasn't really been a novel told through the eyes of a PR fixer and, you know, how they used to whitewash the scandals. Mm-hmm. And it's especially relevant today, given, you know, the Diddy trials and everything like that. I mean, it's just to see. And people who've read the book say that it's, you know, very timely, even though it's a, you know, it's a book about old Hollywood.
Yeah, I imagine working in that field, I've heard, you know, bits and pieces, but that has to be a wild ride. Did you get kind of inspiration from your wife and some of the stories she told you? Or
yeah, and some of, I mean, besides the research, I mean, you know, I've spent a great deal of time, you know, in my early career in Los Angeles, met a lot of people who were in, you know, the entertainment business. And, you know, I've drawn some stories, some actual stories from the book, from people that I've met along the way who are much, much older, of course, and lived during that time. Yeah, it's sort of everything sort of, you know, comes full circle and appears in the book. But yeah, they what's amazing to me about Los Angeles in those days is that they really locked it down. I mean, you know, if you were a star, you were, you know, created, you were groomed, you were looked after like a child in a way, you know, and you had a morals contract, you couldn't do anything supposedly. And they had to really take care of their people in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of the book reminded me of kind of the scandals that you found out about much later that maybe wouldn't be scandals now, but were at that time, like all the Marilyn Monroe antics and what she was up to, and all those things had to be covered up.
Yeah, it's really interesting, but there were amazing fixes that happened. I mean, you know, there's a real fix that happened that I drew inspiration from, where, you know, what did they do if, let's say, a Catholic actress got pregnant and didn't want to have an abortion and keep the baby? Well, you know, what they did was they actually, you know, put the baby into an orphanage and then the star would adopt the baby as her own child, somewhat biblical in a way. Yeah, that truly happened in Hollywood to some major people, like Clark Gable's daughter.
Yeah. So that's amazing. Was there anything that you can talk about from your own experience that you took inspiration from, or is that all
Yes,
still
yes,
hushed?
yes. No, 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 no. I did a my first foray in the advertising business was shooting in Los Angeles when I was in my early 20s. We shot in the home of a in Bel Air. It was with the famous Phyllis George, Miss America, and first female sportscaster. And so she was married to John Y. Brown, the governor of Kentucky, and they founded a chicken. He had originally founded Kentucky Fried Chicken, but they had a company called Chicken by George, and we were shooting, and it was being covered by 2020. And we were in a huge mansion in Los Angeles that was owned by a much, 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 much older man who was very well known. I will not repeat his name. But when he was giving me the tour of the house, he, you know, I complimented him on a painting, and he told me that it had been given to him by a lover of his. And the lover was a very famous movie star who everybody would know. And I was like, really? And, you know, and he said, yes, you know, as well as myself, I've always been a yo-yo. And I was like, what's a yo-yo? And he said, well, you know, I've been with men and women. And then he had been with some of the most famous women and men in the world. And, you know, his experiences that when I was talking to him, you know, I drew inspiration from that in the book, especially with during those days. There's a character in the book who's a dentist and would send his clients to Los Angeles and into the, you know, the hands, if you will, of the gay community who would, you know, help these, you know, young men achieve success and also for their own personal, you know, introductions. So it was, I did just draw that specifically from someone I had met.
Yeah, I love that. And the book was fun to read because it's, you know, it's fiction, but there are real actors and directors and such that you incorporate into the story. Did you try to incorporate facts when mentioning them, or did you just let your imagination run wild?
Well, everything has been carefully researched. And when you're writing a historical novel, it also has to, you have to get a sense of what's going on in the world. But as an example, when, let's say when you're doing a book like that, if you're taking a character from the East Coast to the West Coast, well, how did they get there during that time? You know, they went by the Super Chief, which was called the Train of the Stars, and they would go, you know, spend time on the train, and, you know, they would have elaborate meals and they would socialize. And so you have to put yourself into that time period and then what would happen because of those events that would happen. And that, you know, so everything has been done through heavy research. And I have to say, it was really enjoyable, but it's also, you know, quite daunting to live during that time. You actually have to live in that period.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's sometimes you can get bogged down in research when writing fiction. So yeah, that's amazing. Did you have anything interesting or unusual that you found in your research that particularly struck a chord with you?
Yeah. I mean, I think that there were, let's say, the way that the Lavender marriages worked were very, very, some of them were very, quite successful, if you will. Many of them were arranged by the Hollywood elite and the leading studio heads. But the one thing that I just, you know, which appears in the book was that there was a very famous bordello in Hollywood during the 30s and 40s. And it was owned by a number of people, including some of the studio heads. And this way they would keep track of their stars' peccadilloes and fantasies. And sometimes they would use them, you know, use those against them. But there was one in particular that appears in the book, where they would make up the young ladies to look like movie stars. So if you wanted to spend the night with Lana Turner or Rita Hayworth, you would go to this particular bordello and they would dress the women in wigs and makeup and they would look like them. And that was a, you know, true house of, you know, ill repute, which was in LA, and you know, it was quite famous, and many, you know, notably there were a couple of stars that got their start at that bordello or discovered, and there's a fine line between, you know, some of the, and there was even an instance of one or two of, you know, highly sexed female stars who would work there undercover, do you know what I'm saying? Enjoy themselves, if you will.
And oh, wow.
Yeah, so that was interesting too. But it all appears in the book.
Yeah, and the book was a fun read. It's a quick read. The pacing is fast. I enjoyed it immensely. I just want to shift gears a little bit, if you don't mind, since you are an advertising expert and our listeners have always questions about marketing. So writers today are told they kind of need to think of themselves as a brand. Yes. For someone just starting out, what does that mean? Where do you think they should begin with an author?
Well, I think that you really have to look at the your inner truth and your story. So if you, let's say, if I just finished watching Boots, I don't know if anyone else has watched that.
I watched the trailer. I'm dying to watch it. So that's on my list.
It was executive produced by the late Norman Lear, who was actually a client and a friend that gave me a great quote for my last book before he died. But it was interesting that Norman picked the subject matter because, you know, Norman had an amazing eye. But what's really amazing about, you know, the central character in the book, and it was written by Gay Marine, do you know what I'm saying, was that his truth, and he's built his platform around his truth. And I think that, you know, I'm a, you know, native New Yorker. I've grown up here, I intersect between the worlds of New York and Los Angeles, and, you know, have, you know, spent many a year, even younger, in Los Angeles, the Beverly Hills Hotel and things like that. So I draw inspiration from my truth. And so I think in terms of building a brand, you know, it's very difficult to build a brand if you're trying to be something you're not. You have to go to your inner truth of who you are, what you represent, what your life experience has been, because it is true that you have to draw, you know, through your experience. Now, I always say the character writes the book, and there's, I'm not, you know, if there's a murder in the book, or there's a murderer in the book, or there's, you know, a, let's say someone who is an AV, you know, a pilot in the book, I'm not a pilot, do you know what I'm saying, or any of those things. But the truth of the matter is that, you know, but the genre, the sense of what you're interested in, do you know what I'm saying, has to come from your life experiences and who you are. And so as an example, with the Hollywood Fix, you know, which is of course on now on pre-order on Amazon and, you know, Snowballs and places like that, and it's gotten great reviews. I'm very excited about it, but I've drawn from my own experiences, and I feel I can deliver the truth, and that's where the reviews really come in, because people have said, you know, you really do, you know, it's really a bird's eye view into this. And, you know, listen, I've worked for the studios in marketing, I've worked, you know, doing their, you know, campaigns. I've done, you know, movie posters. I've done theater posters for people like Woody Allen and Norman Lear and things like that. I've worked with the best, and I understand, you know, what it takes to sell a movie, to create a movie. So a lot of that insider knowledge has been transferred to the novel. If you're a Marine, you know, and you can deliver a story about a Marine that, you know, resonates with people, or you're a construction worker and you have a really interesting story to tell, you know what I'm saying, or you're a woman who, you know, works in Walmart and, you know, but you have a really interesting story, you know, people want to know. It's not necessarily relegated to, you know, what profession or where, it's the beauty of who you are and what you can bring to tell the story that you want to tell. And it can happen anywhere at any time.
Yeah, I love that. I think that's something that we try as authors, is to bring that authenticity, right? They bring your personality, bring your authenticity. But lots of writers feel very uncomfortable promoting themselves. So would you have any kind of advice for authors who want to market with authenticity without feeling salesy? Yeah.
It's a great question, you know. And I can only say that everyone, first of all, everyone is a story. Everyone has a story to tell. And everyone's story is beautiful and interesting to other people. That's first and foremost. But the first part of it is, to be a writer, You have to tell the truth and you have to not be afraid. And so, for example, you know, when it comes to writing a sex scene or a love scene, you know, I have children, you know, and I have a wife, and even, you know, I'm writing about, you know, lavender marriages, or I'm doing, you know, I'm writing a love scene between two men. You know, I have to feel comfortable that, you know, when I'm writing it, that, you know, I can write those, you know, those characters and not feel that I'm going to be judged or that there is embarrassment in those ways. And so, you know, that's something that I had to conquer myself because I wanted to tell stories, and not everyone's story is my story. So, you know, but again, you have to be good at that, and you have to put yourself into the mind. So the first thing you have to do is be able to tell the truth, and you have to be able to be not, you know, be fearless. And then once you have that, then only then can you truly start building your brand. It doesn't work the other way around. Everybody wants a brand today,
Yeah.
but brands take time, and brands take hard work, and brands take truth of who you are. And all of that takes very, very long time, you know. And so, and not to feel that you can't evolve. And you know, that's really important. I think I've become a better writer over time.
Yeah, I love that. I always tell myself when I'm writing that I have to pretend my mother's never going to read
And
it.
if she does, you know, I mean, it's, you know, that's, you know, I mean, and by the way, it is amazing to be free to do writing no matter what you want to write about. I mean, I don't want to, it took me a very long time to be able to write from a man's point of view, woman's point of view. And, you know, because if you can't do that, then you can't be a writer.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, so I like that because everyone now is like social media. They think they have to be on there and they think they have to be on, and authors are getting asked to do and more publicity than, you know, maybe 10, 20 years ago. Do you think that that actually moves the needle, like social media
It
when
really does. It really
it
does. But you know what's interesting? For example, if, you know, for some whatever reason, I've been through my career, through my clients, through, you know, that I've been thrust into the world of the rich and famous.
Yeah.
So, you know, people really want to know what's going on in that world and has gone on in that world. And so I'm able, you know, as a brand, as a writer, to be able to deliver that. You know, I had a column in the New York Observer called "Isn't That Rich? Life Among the 1%." It became a book. It was sold to ABC, and it was, you know, I interviewed, you know, very, very wealthy, you know, socialites and, you know, financiers and New Yorkers and people like that, and people from Palm Beach. And, you know, the column was, you know, very big success. And, you know, I never mentioned anyone's names, but I was able to really deliver a unique view about what it was like to have 1 foot in the 1% and 1 foot out of the 1%. And people really responded to the material, you know, but it was very controversial. The thing also is, you have to be, if you're a writer and you're going to do anything great, you know, you may ruffle a few feathers. And I remember going to more than one cocktail party in the Hamptons or in down in Palm Beach or wherever, and people would point to me and they would, you know, say, "Oh, there's that guy who writes those, you know, you shouldn't be writing." I can't tell you how many people come up to me and say, "You shouldn't be writing that about us, people like us." And I said, "Well, what do you mean people like us?" You know? And so, you know, but it took me again a long time to be comfortable in terms of writing about things I wanted to write about and not seeking people's approval.
Yeah, I think, you know, that can get into your head, people, what people are saying. And I don't know. I don't read my reviews. Do you read your reviews?
Yeah, I
You
really do. My reviews, I know this is going to sound terrible, maybe I have great reviews. You know, like the book is like, you know, we've had, you know, the Hollywood Fix has, you know, been on NetGalley and, you know,
Yeah.
Amazon, and several, you know, they're all 5-star reviews. So it's like, for the most part. So I'm like, I mean, I would feel badly if I was getting 1 and 2-star reviews. At the same time, you know, as I said before, you know, you know, I'll have like 10 reviews at a time, let's say, and it'll be like 5-star, 5-star, 5-star. And then every once in a while there'll be a hater and it'll be like 1-star. And but I like being polarizing. You know, really interesting. If you're in the middle, that's where I would have the worst time. Like, I don't mind if somebody loves it or somebody hates it. I would mind it if people were indifferent.
Yeah. So embrace your negative haters and
Yeah, it's just, yeah, some people are going to, you get, not everybody's going to like you or like what you do. I mean, there's, it's fine, you know? And, you know, I once had, there was a guy that I was friendly with, that I was friendly with. And I remember calling him up on the phone. I said, well, I heard you're, you know, saying negative things about the writing. And he tried to recover and said, well, I'm your true friend. I'm the one who'll tell you what I really think. And I said, but that's the whole problem. You're not talking to me about it. You're talking to other people about it. So I think that, you know, but again, you know, I, you know, the weeding out process, whether it's personal or professional, sometimes you have to do that too. Like, you know, but I don't want people in my life. I don't mind if someone gives me healthy criticism. You know, there's a difference between, you know, healthy criticism to make you a better writer and people just bad talking you. Do you know what I'm saying? But you can't be afraid of those things because, again, you know, if you're going to be, you know, interesting and exciting and, you know, provide people with something that they're really going to think is, you know, wow, that's something really fun to read. Well, then, yeah, you're going to ruffle a few feathers along the way. And you know, and whether it's your friends, your family, people that you know. And so you can't worry about that. That's just all that worry is, you know, just standing in the way of you and the story that you want to tell.
Yeah. And I guess they always say there's no such thing as bad press or bad attention.
Well, it depends on. I mean, I wouldn't think Prince Andrew would probably agree with that.
Well, yeah, maybe not right now. Yeah. Sorry about your titles, Prince Andrew, I guess. I don't know.
Right. But I think but for the most part, I think it's true.
Yeah. So I'm curious, coming from advertising, that's really storytelling.
Yes.
And you want to be big and splashy and make an impact. And that's kind of the point, right? And to emotionally connect with audiences. Yeah. Do you have any tips that you've brought from that world to your fiction?
Yeah. Well, the most amazing thing that I'm going to tell you is that also who you meet along the way will guide you. So if you can believe it, I was hired as a young copywriter by none other than James Patterson before he became the world's most famous author. And James hired me at J. Walter Thompson. And when you said that the story moves along quickly, one of the great lessons I learned in advertising and also in writing is that James really invented the three-page chapter, if you will, because what he really understood, and this is why one of the reasons why he's such an amazing success and great storyteller, is that people, you know, don't have a huge amount of time. They want to feel accomplished. At the end of the evening, they want to get into bed and they want to read a chapter. But if a chapter is 20 pages long, you know, you're never going to, it's never going to move the story along. And so he was one of the first people to really do that and to really sort of the brevity of telling a story and to move the story quickly. And so I learned that from him. And it was one of the great gifts, you know. And the other thing was when I was writing for Joan Rivers, you know, by the way, $8 a joke, my friends.
$8 a joke.
$8 a joke. I actually took one of the checks and framed it because it was worth more than the actual paycheck. But, you know, but Joan was amazing. And Joan gave me a great lesson. I once wrote this joke and she said to me, she said, Richard, she edited it. And she said, you know, you can't have two punchlines in a joke. Like she said, you know, you know, make sure that it breathes and it's able to sing on its own. So, you know, she sliced and diced the joke, and the joke went from being, you know, relatively unfunny, you know, even though I thought it was funny at the time, to really funny by just the air that you give and the editing process. So I think that, you know, I try with every client and with every person that I meet that I respect to take away one thing from those people. And so, for example, in my advertising career, I was hired by Steve Wynn and the great Elaine Wynn in Hot Las Vegas. And I created the Wynn logo and for the Wynn Hotel, the signature that was Steve's signature. And Steve was all about the details. And that's one of the things I took about him. He could walk through a casino. He could see a rapper on the floor, you know, 20 feet away, and he would walk over and pick it up, or he would recognize, you know, that a croupier, you know, say, hey, Donna, is that a new hairstyle? I mean, it was unbelievable to me. And, you know, and that, but again, it was all in the details. And if you, at the end of the signature of the win, there's a little period. And Steve said to me, I don't understand, why are we including that period? I said, that's part of your signature. There's a little dot at the end. I said, and that's you being declarative. And he loved that because that was part of his brand and his signature, and the fact that he's all about the details. So everything is about the person and their story to tell and who they are and the level of authenticity they bring to the table. And I hope that when people read The Hollywood Fix, they're going to really love the details, you know, the details in the book, what it was like to live in the 1930s and 40s, what it was like to be, you know, trapped in Europe and then have to come to the United States and be transformed into a star, you know, what you had to leave behind, you know, the details about not being being able to access funds in a Swiss bank account because, you know, you didn't have the death certificate, you know, at a time when there were no death certificates to have, or eating in a restaurant in Beverly Hills during that time and realizing, you know, where the Cobb salad was invented, if you will, or what it was like to have lunch at the Brown Derby. I mean, those things are really fun. And, you know, and I think that, you know, or the fact that Hedda Hopper, the great PR publicist, you know, who controlled, you know, the social press for the Hollywood stars, you know, loved her hats. And she always wore an amazing hat and had a great, she was always veiled in these hats and amazing. I mean, those are the little details that make a book really, you know, scrumptious, I think, right?
Yeah, I think so. And there are plenty in there. And I think also your dialogue is great. It feels so authentic to that time period and to the people. And the humor. So you said you wrote for Joan Rivers. You've got Groucho in there, and he has a few great lines that I don't, were those your jokes or?
Some of them were his, yeah. Some of them were my own. But for example, you know, the character of Solomon Myers, who's the great movie executive, who speaks, you know, I channeled my grandfather, Harry, who was a New York City policeman, and he would call women dames, and, you know, everybody was, you know, he spoke with D's, Dems, and Does, like New York style. And so, you know, I think the humor of that time period, and the, you know, he was an equal opportunity hater. So he was like, you know, he was a really lovable guy, but he would just, you know, he was sort of, you know, it was, he just would, everybody, everything that came out of his mouth sounded unwoke. So yeah. You know, I really tried to channel that into the movie executive and what he was like during that period of time. And I think it's really funny. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if you did, but I thought it was
funny. I like the running joke of Barty not understanding half of what he's saying. So that was, a fun time. Do you have any humor tips? That's always something that's a struggle for a lot of writers. I just kind of don't do it because I can't get it right.
I mean, I think that if a character, like, for example, the character of Solomon Myers is really modeled after like the Louis B. Mayers of the time.
Yeah.
They, you know, so for example, he had something, I hope I pronounced this right, we call malapropism, and where he was known for saying things that were, because he was, you know, he wasn't, English wasn't his first language. So he would say things that were often repeated in Hollywood that people found very amusing, even though he was very funny. Like, he didn't realize it was, so for example, that character says things and it's in broken English and in Yiddish, and he doesn't understand that what he's saying is hilarious, right?
Yeah.
So part of the humor is the fact that he doesn't know he's being funny, right? Now, there are other characters in, you know, the book and in other things I've written that know they're funny. I mean, Joan Rivers knew she was funny,
yeah.
You know? So for example, she could really turn it on at any point, you know, and that was really a pleasure to be around. But yeah, I think when it comes to humor, it's, once again, I always get back to, if you're writing about a character, is the character, like within humor, there are people who are, you know, funny, haha, funny, witty, sarcastic, funny, you know, have bro humor, you know, it's a lot of different ways to, and ideas of what is funny. But if you, so for example, the character in the book of, you know, Solomon Myers, he doesn't realize he's being funny, but he's hilarious. And then his quotes are always, called Meyerisms or traded in Hollywood steam rooms and over dinner parties because everyone thinks what he's saying is hilarious, And then they're real. I actually think they're really funny. But those are made up myself. Those were not taken from, historical background.
Yeah, no, it was great. So that was a fun read, and we're almost out of time. So just as we're wrapping up, we have one question we like to ask everyone. If you had any advice for writers who are just starting out, newer writers, what would it be?
Yeah. Well, first of all, my advice to writers starting out would be to write. And, I think you need to be on a writing schedule. I think you have to have time management. People don't understand that it takes years to do a book. It takes usually a full year, but it could be 3 years of research, putting the book away, bringing it out. And the only way to really do that is to write, 1 to 5 pages or 10 pages a week. In order to get to a book and then to rewrite it and to rewrite it and to rewrite it and to rewrite it. And then when you have an editor, they send it, then you have to rewrite it. So I always say to my friends, like, this is my golf to my guy friends. They're like, how do you write these books? And I'm like, well, this is my golf. They're on the tee and they're going and spending every weekend doing that. Well, I'm spending every 3 or 4 times a week, I'm having my writer's lunches. So you're never going to write a book also if you don't have time. So for what I'll do is I'll go to a great bar. I love Irish bars, by the way. I love writing in an Irish bar. My mother was a Joycean scholar. I love going to that particular flavor of bar because people are garrulous and they're fun, and I just get to sit there and immerse myself into, being able to sit at the bar and write and not have to talk to anybody, not, go into a solitary place, but plug in my headphones and just, write. So my advice to young writers is to write. And if you really don't want to write and you feel it's a chore for you, then you're never going to write a book and you should probably do something else. But if you love to write and you love to write in places that you love to write. Oh, by the way, at the end of my books, I always put where I wrote, where what inspired me, along the way. So I'll say this restaurant, this hotel, this pool, this bar, Irish bar, something like that. Because I really credit a lot of those places for inspiration. So find your spot, find, if you want to go, go sit at, Ruby Tuesdays on it, on a Thursday night and sit at the bar and just, bring your computer or your pad and paper and write. And you know what I'm saying? But find your spot that inspires you, that you love to write at, and that's my advice to young writers.
Okay, my first question is, JD, do you have any good celebrity babysitting stories?
Ooh, yes.
Oh,
Tell us. Come
no,
on.
I am not going there. The funny thing is, like, when I was listening to this, like, that is the age that he wrote this book is the golden age. Like, they could have if a celebrity had a problem, you really just had to get in front of, a couple of reporters, try and stop them from going to press the next day. It was a manageable situation. When I was dealing with, rock stars and stuff in the 90s, social media wasn't quite there yet. So we were still kind of in that same boat, but news traveled a little faster. In today's world, it's literally minutes, if not seconds, of something bad happening, and it's everywhere. Worldwide. So you can't get in front of that. All you can do is damage control. And I think any amount of celebrity that you have, whether you're small or big, you're going to get exposed to this. It's going to happen. Like, I've had my fun brush with it. And I will gladly, put that in the rearview mirror, but like you learn from it. The same people that were fixing these things, back in the 30s, like they've evolved too. They're still here. They're still dealing with it. They're just dealing with it in different ways. But it's fascinating to see. I mean, back then in the 30s, everything was very different. Hollywood, like the studios actually owned the stars. They were salaried employees. They did their movies. They did nobody else's movies. So they guarded that. That was a commodity. So if somebody had a problem, they would fix it. They'd make it go away. But that problem would be documented. It'd be put in a file somewhere. And then when they needed that star to do something they didn't want to do, that file would come back out and they would use that information. And it's like this whole, giant circle of nastiness.
Yeah. Well, Richard has a lot of experience in branding. So I thought his advice was interesting. We've heard it. So I don't think it's new, but I think it's hard, which is basically speak your truth. Be fearless. Don't be afraid to ruffle feathers. Don't worry about people's approval. What did you think about that?
That's the advice I live by.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess it's kind of true. Like, that is the thing about branding. And like a lot of people think that to, you know, like, oh, be your authentic self. And then they think like, oh, I have to reveal like everything about myself. But, you know, you can still choose like what pieces of you you want to share with the public.
Right.
But you do want to, I do think that you have that truth. Otherwise, you end up with sort of like, I think that we've all seen it where it's like people who come across and there's just like sort of a like a wall or like there's just something that and it doesn't catch on, right? Because they're trying to be what they think their audience wants instead of like themselves. So I do think that people pick up on that. I think that it's like if you're trying too hard, people sense that, I think. Yeah.
Well, yeah. It goes back to like the 30s. Back in the day, you could put on a persona because you were only doing it for those 10 minutes you were in front of the press cameras and then you walked away and you could be your own self. And that dynamic is completely flipped on its head today. You know, you basically have to be your authentic self, you know, 24/7, because if you try to put on a persona, you can't keep it up.
Yeah.
The key is to be personable, but not personal. So you want to be your authentic self, but you don't have to reveal every little detail about your life. You know, you can be very selective about what gets out there, but you can't lie about it. Like you can't make up things. And because people will spot that right away, especially in this age where everybody's online 24/7, you know, you got YouTube channels and TikTok, you know, feeds and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. They're going to notice that you're not consistent. You know, so it's easier to be consistent when you are being yourself and telling the truth than it is to maintain a persona.
Well, and I also think like kind of going back to what JD said, like back in like the 30s, right? Like the people who were doing this were also like skilled actors, right? And so they were very versed in portraying different people, right? And so now because we do sort of have more of that like unfiltered, unedited, quote unquote. I know everyone edits and filters, but you know, it's more, you're not necessarily, you could have a public persona and not necessarily be an actor. And acting is very, very, very hard to do it like in a way that, you know, someone believes that you're someone else. That's very, very, very hard. And I think that's why people pick up on when it's not, when you're putting on a show. If you're not, it's very difficult. And I think it's very easy to get quote unquote caught, I think.
Yeah. So can I build a brand out of boredom, like just me reading with my cat and working out in my basement? That's cool.
I think you can. I guess I'll get there. Why not?
So the other thing that I thought was interesting is that Richard was actually a copywriter for James Patterson many years ago. And I liked, you know, I've always thought about those short chapters as people have short interest span. But he said, no, people want to feel accomplished. So when you finish a chapter, it's that sense of accomplishment. I don't know. Do you have thoughts about that?
Well, a lot of Jim's original co-authors came out of that marketing, you know, firm that he worked at. And he twisted everything, like, you know, because he didn't really have a marketing background. You know, we talked about this at Author Nation. He started at the bottom of the company as a copy editor, ended up being CEO by the time he walked out the door. And it was mainly because he didn't really know the industry when he went in. Mm-hmm. And everything that he did was just so different that it worked. Mm-hmm. I remember in his autobiography, he mentions when he first started hiring people, he put an ad in the newspaper and basically described the ingredients that were in like a can of beans. And like, I want you to write me, the ad was write me a letter, you know, using these ingredients and, you know, make me want to buy this product. You know, like, and that was just an ad in the back of the newspaper and people answered it. And like, that's how he hired, you know, most of his employees. It wasn't like, you know, looking for a seasoned copy editor with 15 years experience on this and that. Yeah. Like he was looking for somebody who could sell him a can of beans. You know, so like guys like Richard, I think they, you know, they got an education, I think, working with them, you know, back in the day.
There's this book, God, I'm going to have to remember the name and find it, but it's something like, I don't know, The History of Scientific Invention or something. It's an older book, but they basically go through and they talk about how every major disruption in industry, over like the last 100 or so years, 150 years, have come from people outside of that industry. So I think it's really interesting what you said about James Patterson. Like, he wasn't a marketing guy, and yet he changed marketing. And like, you see that so many times, that when an industry gets disrupted, it's never from the people who are like the old hands at it, because you get like a certain bias, right? You look at things a certain way and you sort of get that like, oh, we can't do it that way because this is how it's always been done. And sometimes you do need like a James Patterson to come through and be like, I'm going to do it this way. And then it works. And then everything changes.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That's awesome. Or a Ted Lasso, I suppose. Bring a football guy in to play some other football that we call soccer. All right. With that, JD, who's up next week?
Next week, we've got Bob Lingle coming on. This one's a little different for us. Bob actually owns a fantastic bookstore in upstate New York called The Good Neighbor. He's a fixture on social media, particularly TikTok, when new titles come out. But also when there's changes in the industry, he throws a lot of comments out there and he's very insightful. So he's going to fill us in on how just the changing publishing landscape has impacted booksellers. Hopefully, you know, explain how we might be able to get titles into a bookstore and, you know, what it takes to actually succeed in that world and where he thinks things are going. So Bob Lingle.
Yeah, it's going to be great. If you'd like to be notified as soon as new episodes publish, make sure you go to writersincpodcast.com and sign up now. We'll see you next episode and have a great week of writing.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Writers Inc. Access the show notes and leave a comment at writersincpodcast.com.